Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
I think there's more than a little bit of an issue in the degree to which American exceptionalism has become a kind of an aspect of a culture war where, you know, basically both sides are racing for exceptionalism. So remember, the right now is typically going to say we're the freest, greatest, most powerful, wonderful nation in the world. The inverse of exceptionalism on the left is we are the worst, most terrible, most destructive, most, you know, venal country in the world. Like, if we're not the best, we're the worst. They are both a distortion, right? They are both American exceptionalism. The anti-exceptionalism on the left is just as unhumble. You know, it's the arrogance of terribleness.
Guys know we love history, and any chance to look at something that seems like it's from the past, something that seems like it's not particularly relevant, but when brought into the present day, helps us understand our country, a country and a world, frankly, that are realigning, that are changing. And today's episode then is going to focus on Inside Money, Brown Brothers Harriman and the American Way of Power. It is by Zachary Carabell, and it seems kind of random. You probably have not heard of Brown Brothers Harriman. It's not the biggest firm. It's not the type of thing which we mention the same names as Goldman Sachs or any of those other big places that played a huge role in the 2008 financial crisis and all of the debates moving forward. But as Zachary hits during this interview and in the book, which we cannot recommend enough, Brown Brothers Harriman, the story of it emerging from a small immigrant firm in Baltimore in the 1800s, all the way up through the 20th century, really tells a financial history of the United States. And what's so great about the book is that it actually helps you better understand, through this historical story, the actual state of our country when it comes to finance, US and China, and all the stuff we love covering here.
I really enjoy talking with Zach. He's a very, very sharp guy. And even though we differ a bit on China policy, the history he's telling is fundamentally correct about how Wall Street conducted itself, the way that the elites of America and the architects of basically the entire U.S.-led international order conceived of themselves, what they came from. And it is crazy how much of it has to do with this single firm on Wall Street, which continues to survive to this day. So he is somebody who is an authority on this subject and who I learned a lot from during this discussion.
And something to think about from a what question is this episode interested in? Pretty early on, he points out the fact that the elites that came from Brown Brothers Harriman, that class of people, they were very white. They are very specific. There's this funny line where I assume he's Jewish, frankly, that he said none of us would have been allowed in any of these spaces. And it's weird that we're talking about it. There's all these obvious critiques of that system and those people. But the dilemma that we all acknowledge during the episode is that despite all of those problems, these are the same elites that won World War II, set up the international system after that war, built the Hoover Dam, got us to space, all those sort of things. As we're looking at our current elite, as we're looking at our current system, why is it that despite opening up, why is it despite being more meritocratic, it feels as if to everyone, regardless of whether you're political or not, that the system is just still not working today? And we don't have an answer to that, but I think it's something that all of us as a host, authors, listeners should be thinking about.
Yeah, that's right. And as always, you can pick up Zach's book or any book that you want over at The Realignment's Bookshop, which is available in our show notes. It's a great way to help a bookstore during the COVID-19 pandemic, and it helps our work here at The Realignment. So with that, let's get to the question and answer period.
Quick reminder, you can leave us a question by emailing us at realignmentpod@gmail.com, or you can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts with your question there. And yes, we've received incoming from people. There is a huge questions backlog. We promise, as long as you did not ask anything too weird, we will 100% get to you by the end of the summer. But here's the question from Apple. It's from Mavhershi. Hey guys, regular listener here, although I'm more left-aligned politically. I love your show and find it to be a good faith attempt to present your side of the story. I wouldn't have given Senator Hawley the time of day, but I don't resent you for doing it. I have some questions on this topic in particular, but also about other things you've covered in the past. So, Senator Hawley attempts to explain his position against monopolies in an extremely disingenuous way in my book. One, he has a poor understanding of who the customers of their products are. The customers are advertisers, and they love Facebook, Twitter, Google, and Amazon, but it allows them to micro-target audiences with the least money spent. These platforms have substantially reduced the barrier to entry for small business advertisers who never would be able to afford the reach of CBS or Fox or any other big media company. And two, if he was actually serious about this at all, he would extend his critique to all industries, including Boeing, Northrop Grumman, or Halliburton, who actually have government-funded monopolies of huge barriers to entry. It's easy to bootstrap a Twitter rival. It's nigh impossible to build a startup airplane manufacturer. Why do you think no one considers this more urgent?
It's a great question and pretty astute there in your analysis. So I actually don't disagree with you in terms of the way that the monopoly conversation should be. Look, Senator Hawley is a politician and a GOP politician, which is that he's talking about monopoly in the context of tech because GOP voters are angry about tech. But I do think that if you were to look at some of his work, but even people more broadly who he's drawing intellectual thought from, a lot of them are making the same points that you're making. And what I would also add is that those companies that you listed are not, it's not like they're doing all that great of a job. They're doing very well in terms of implementing the status quo, but in terms of innovating in their sector, most of them are a complete and total disaster, hence the SpaceX story and all of that. So I think there's a great conversation there to be had, but this is just me speaking as to why a politician is acting like a politician. Well, I think that one answers its own question.
There's quite literally nothing I had to say to follow up to what you just said, because that's it exactly. The point is, look, that episode was really specifically about helping you all understand the front-facing case for how the right is going to talk about tech. That was not supposed to be presented as, here is our empirical analysis of where the real monopoly problem lies in America.
Right.
Here is why Twitter follows are the equivalent of defense procurement. Because once again, that's what you're really getting at with your question. And I think once you take a step back and push back from the palace intrigue, push back from the politics, you'll see that we should be weighing these things totally differently. So there's nothing that you said that I basically would disagree with there. But great question. Good point. We really appreciate it.
As always, a special thank you to the Linker Network for sponsoring this podcast. Let's dive in.
Zachary Carabell, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you, Marshall.
So almost no one in our audience has heard of Brown Brothers Harriman. It's total guarantee. This is probably not the first time you've heard this. So let's just start very simply. What does the story of this firm tell about the history, the rise of American capitalism, and where we really are today?
So you're totally right. Almost nobody has heard of Brown Brothers, even in the financial world. So Brown Brothers is a 220 plus year old investment bank that still exists and is probably the longest private bank that's still in existence, full stop. And as I do say, if not in the book, when I do interviews, living long is not in and of itself a reason to celebrate. And the fact that they've been around for that long is not a reason to write a book about them. But living well is. And part of the reason why they are not remembered is because they stay sort of private and insular rather than public and spectacular. So when all these investment firms that people are familiar with, like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, and then more infamously like Lehman Brothers, all of these began their lives at some point in the 19th or early 20th century as private partnerships, and they did what they did, and we can get into that. And then they go public in the 70s and 80s and into the early 90s. And when they go public, they become massive and huge. They become these, you know, multi-billion dollar behemoths that to some degree are lauded for a while and then excoriated and then lauded and then excoriated, depending on when. And we know them. We know them because they were at the center of the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, they garner a lot of headlines and they epitomize a certain sensibility and image of what finance and Wall Street is. And part of what I try to bring out in the book is there's this other firm, Brown Brothers Harriman, that for decades of its existence was just as central and just as important as Goldman and as Lehman and as Morgan Stanley, but isn't today, because they didn't go that path. And we remember the destructive elements of what Wall Street has become or became. And we don't remember as much the less destructive elements. And maybe it's part of that's human nature. You know, I once wrote a book about peace in the Middle East, and, you know, it was important, but it's not as exciting as war. So I think there's a degree to which we pay attention to what's dramatic, because that's what human beings do. But we do so somewhat at our peril when we forget not just what was less dramatic, but what might be and is more sustainable.
A good way of capturing the sensibility of Brown Brothers Harriman, I think this was either in your Wall Street Journal excerpt or your Atlantic excerpt, is that you pointed out that they wouldn't have backed Elon Musk. And in reading that comment, I couldn't tell whether you were saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. So can you just give some context to that?
Sure. And I think it's a matter of what the balance is. So think of Brown Brothers as your epitome slash cliche of what a staid, stolid banker of yore was. Like they dress in black. They are Presbyterian men, and they are all men, and they are all white men of rectitude, right? They carry themselves. They have good posture. They, you know, one of the only great crises and one of the great grandsons of Alexander Brown, who was an Irish Presbyterian linen merchant who goes to Baltimore in 1800. One of his grandsons has like the great crisis in his young life when he goes off to Yale. And a lot of them went to Yale, just to add to the whole cliched, you know, image and panoply. And his great crisis was, should I smoke? Not weed, you know, should I smoke cigarettes? And he's writing to his father these kind of very anguished, earnest letters of, you know, dear Pater. I mean, he doesn't call him Pater, but he just as well could have. You know, should I do this? And I think it's fine. And I'll keep it in limit. I won't spend too much money. And his father writes back like some weird amalgam of Poor Richard and Polonius. You know, my son, you've come to one of the great crises in your life. And I think, look, if that's, you know, if that's the great crisis in your life, that says something about like where you are in the panoply of human society. So they're like men of rectitude, and they conduct themselves that way. And we can get into some of the ways that are far less savory, but nonetheless. And my point about the Elon Musk is, this is a culture that was ever mindful of risk because it was their money, and ever mindful that like, if they made the wrong decision, if they backed the wrong horse, it wasn't just bad reputation. It was, they would lose their own money. They could lose their house. They could lose their firm. They could lose their business. And that they were always prepared for something going wrong the next day. Like, they always went to bed at night with their books balanced and ready for a crisis. They would have been really well prepared for a pandemic. And most people weren't. So they wouldn't have backed Elon Musk. They wouldn't have backed some guy coming in going, wow, I've got this, you know, hope and dream and no chance of making money, maybe forever. But I don't say it as either celebratory or condemnatory. I say it as, you actually, I think, in a healthy balance, want the heart of your financial system, because money is power, but it's also dangerous power, to be really mindful of the dangerous power and not just rushing to make a lot of money, not just tripping over themselves for the constructive power. So you, I think you want at the center, you want people who'd be like, you know, that Musk guy, that's kind of interesting, but not for us. But you don't want none of it. So my point about Brown Brothers is, you don't want a world of only staid bankers. I just think you want a world where the center is more conservative, small c conservative, and the hub is more conservative. The spokes are where the risk comes. And I think in the world we live in today, that got inverted. And so the conservative, you know, they're like, hey, we're not going to go there, epitomizes much more of the periphery. And the, can we find something where we can invest and we'll get 100x, you know, whether it's Bitcoin or Musk. And I am not poo-pooing that at all. That is vital and important and innovative and interesting. But it shouldn't be where the core of your system is.
Right. Yeah, it shouldn't be the core of the American financial system. And it definitely does seem, at least from a media perspective and more, that's where things are today. It's funny, though, most people may not know Brown Brothers Harriman. But, you know, I'm a big history nerd, and this is an integral part of the story. I'm like, oh, of course, Harriman, Avril Harriman, right? I mean, this is somebody integral to, you know, the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, FDR, so much of rising through like the Democratic New York establishment and the parallels of the firm and power. So from that perspective, like, what does the story of the firm say about the establishment of like the post-World War II international order, the different institutions and agencies that supported it at the time. Go into that aspect of the history.
So yeah, so Brown Brothers Harriman is essentially part of the establishment of the establishment. You know, exactly. They are the card-carrying members of this core, of this coterie. And what people will be familiar with, even if they're not familiar with Avery Harriman, I mean, lots of New Yorkers go up to Harriman State Park. They probably don't realize it's because E.H. Harriman, who's one of the greatest railroad barons of the late 19th and early 20th century, that's where he lived. And like a lot of railroad barons, right, he didn't really build the railroads. He bought the bonds that built the railroads after right. people who built the railroads went bust. So yeah, Harriman was this debonair, a man of the world. The New Yorker wrote a two-part profile of him in the 1940s and called him the plenipotentiary because he was like the roving ambassador at large for Roosevelt and then for Truman and then to some degree for JFK. And he was governor of New York. But people will remember Prescott Bush, or at least they'll mm-hmm. remember the name Bush, because Prescott Bush is the father of George Herbert Walker Bush. And, you know, again, my point is not in this book to either really celebrate these men for that or condemn them for it, because there's, I think, you could make a case on either direction of that equation. But it is to recognize their pivotal role in designing the world that we live in. And I think there is a danger in the pendulum swinging today. And I mean this very specifically, right? That, you know, we have to kind of confront our whiteness because that's so much a part of the history that made us. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of problems with that with Brown Brothers Harriman. But the fact that we forgot it so much and that the relationship between money and power was so integral in the mid 20th century, you know, it really was partly men of finance and money who designed all these international institutions that totally benefited the United States and were designed to essentially enshrine the centrality of the United States in the global economic system. Nothing more so than the Bretton Woods system, which creates the dollar. But another one of the partners of Brown Brothers, a man named Robert Lovett, who was Under Secretary of State and then Secretary of Defense, really helps design the precursor of the World Trade Organization, the General That's Agreement right. on Tariffs and Trade. So like we're living in their world. We may not like the world, or we may think it's amazing, depending on where you are in the political spectrum. Either way, it's their architecture. It's like if you're in a building, they built it. And it may be fallen apart and it may be shoddy and there may be some skeletons, you know, buried in the concrete, but it's their building. And if you want to change the building or tear it down, you'd best understand who built it and how it came to be.
That's well said. You
know, I'm really glad that you just addressed like the whiteness thing in the sense that if you're looking at that establishment, there are obviously some things that you don't have to be super left to like agree that, because there's a right-wing version of this, that there's this East Coast specific elite, which had one very specific set of beliefs that came from a very specific set of schools and wasn't open to basically all parts of society. This isn't just like a racial right. comment. So that being said, this elite, there's always this contradiction when we're thinking of like the history of the 20th century is, despite all these problems, this elite was incredibly competent in a way that I feel most people feel, at least intangibly, the elite of today isn't. Despite the fact that the elite today is much more meritocratic, despite the fact that the institutions that these elites run are much more accessible to folks, on and on and on and on. And you really see after the 1960s, just a total collapse of trust in all the institutions that the folks were talking about really set up, and they ran just total collapse when they're more open than ever. So can you address what really happened here? What was it that made this elite, for good or for ill, able to build the Hoover Dam, able to win World War II, able to set something up, you know, the Marshall Plan, all these things that we can maybe gloss over. And look, this all ends in the Vietnam War, so that's part of the story there. But just what happened over the course of the next 50 years?
So it's interesting. I mean, there was a big book, I don't know when, 80s, Christopher Lash, about kind of the death of the elites.
Yes.
The degree to which the 60s and 70s. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't get that. But that the 60s and 70s blows apart this kind of tight-knit, you know, WASP, all went to Ivy schools and the same grade schools. And look, when Brown Brothers Harriman comes together, it's a merger of Brown Brothers, which is the 1800 bank, and Harriman's firm, which it was really a new firm. like 12 of the 17 partners go to Yale, and you know, 9 of them are in Skull and Bones, and they all go to Groton. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, it really was that interwoven. And then you add in Dean Acheson, who went to Princeton, but who cares, and Kennan. I mean, they're all sort of in the same soup. And by the way, just so we're clear, like this group of guys, part of the way Brown Brothers makes its fortune is by dominating the cotton trade in the 1830s and 1840s, which is, you know, totally complicit in a slave system. And they were also anti-slavery, just to add to the, you know, self-contradictory behavior of human beings then and now. And I think the elite thing is fascinating because you point out today, and one thing I do, I mean, I indicate in the book, and then I've also really hammered home since the publication and articles and interviews, is you would think the elites of today being, as you said, more meritocratic and from a wider range would be more in tune with the relationship between their fortunes, literally, and the public good. And what's fascinating is they seem to be even less in tune with that.
Much less, yeah.
As opposed to this really cosseted, you know, male elite who were drilled into the notions of public service. I mean, the whole motto of Groton was to reign is to serve.
Mm-hmm. And to clarify, and Groton was a high school, or not high school, it's a boarding school.
Boarding school, where I believe FDR went there, right? A lot.
I mean, like anyway, all the Roosevelts loved it. It was like a Roosevelt, you know, training ground. And I don't believe that that was hypocritical, right? And I suppose we could have a whole debate of, look, there are people who just believe it was all self-serving. I happen to believe that one can simultaneously be self-serving and of service. You know, that human beings are a weird agglomeration of contradictory impulses. And I believe that they believed that it was their duty, literally, to attend to the public good because they understood that they couldn't beggar the commons endlessly. That their fortunes and the fortunes of society were ultimately linked. And therefore, they had a responsibility to make sure that everybody thrived ultimately, because they kind of knew that they couldn't unless everyone did. And that then extends to the world at large after World War II. The whole point of the Marshall Plan and creating this post-war architecture, one was to fight communism, but it was to fight communism because of belief that, you know, capitalism and an open market was a better system to achieve human freedoms and affluence. And that if you didn't help them develop, they were going to collapse, and therefore you were going to be imperiled.
Yeah.
So again, serving and self-serving were so intimately, ineluctably interwoven. And today, you know, like, where are the tech elites today in talking about the public good and talking about public service? You know, it seems to be that their version of public service is massive private philanthropy on the one hand, and some belief in the utopian potential of what they're doing to sort of break the cycle of human suffering and need. And maybe that utopian vision will prove to be true, but right now it does seem like they're kind of absent.
You know, I've thought a lot about this. I think that what it comes to, and this is especially if you read a history of George H.W. Bush, as you say, in today in 2021 and more, it can sound hokey. But they legitimately did believe very strongly in noblesse oblige, for lack of a better word. And I believe that it is part of the explicit acknowledgement of, hey, we're at the top here. And in order to maintain that, what we learned from our British cousins and from what happened during the American Civil War is that things can go south real quick in terms of popularizing and more, which means we have a duty to architect a system, as you're saying, which is both self-serving, but broadly serving. That the veneer of meritocracy gives a sense of entitlement to people who maintain very much largely some of the same systems and more, but without any of the original noblesse oblige of Groton. A lot of this has to do with the expansion of the, you know, professional managerial class and all of that as well, from like 5% to 20% of the population. Same thing with college rates, etc. I think it's really interesting to think of it from that perspective. And around architecting then this American rules-based establishment. So that brings us kind of into this thing where they created these guys, the American century. They are the fathers, the architects of it, because they believed in their country, self-serving and serving, but also very much creating a large, great country would prosper together. Of course, them at the top, no question about it. But let's define that term then. Like, what was the American century and what role did they play in creating it beyond what you've already laid out there?
Right. And just like to add to the embedded irony of this conversation, you know, we are here talking about a book that I wrote about a class that was a closed but public-minded elite. And none of us could have been in those rooms.
Yeah.
Like, right. In this conversation. Yeah. we are all politely asked to leave should we have shown up at one of the clubs or one of the rooms. And you know, that was the nature of most societies, right? They were tribal and closed, and this was a particular one. This whole conversation of it is fascinating that the rise of a meritocracy seems to have come with an unburdening of those who have profited most from a sense of their ultimate responsibilities to the collective. And that's a matter of culture more than it's a matter of government and regulations, right? You can regulate actions. I don't think you can regulate culture. And a lot of this came from a culture that in turn, you know, we're going to be spending decades unwinding the kind of particular reaction in the 60s and 70s toward the way things were. Because in many ways, between the populism of Donald Trump and the general arc of the world, you know, we are in an ever gradual unwinding of a particular set of 20th century systems without a clear sense of what's being constructed in their place. All I feel sure about, and I am not rose-tinted in that, there is no going back. You cannot cherry pick the past, right? You can't say, oh, that was great. They were civic-minded and they were responsible for a system and wouldn't that be good? It wouldn't be good if it included all of the lack of inclusion that that world did. But you can certainly learn trenchant lessons from their culture and demand that those be embedded in our contemporary world in a way that it's clearly not. Like one of the ironies too is in the 1940s and 50s, as they were busy creating this hierarchical pyramidal elite system, the average differential between worker pay and CEO pay was about 30 to 35 to one. You know, what is it today? I'm sure you guys know around what it is.
I don't even know.
It's in the hundreds.
It's above
right. Hundreds, capital right? gains, all that. Yeah. Right. It's a whole other story.
And you know, and maybe it's fine that it's 300 to one. Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying it's fascinating that these people who were located themselves at the top of the pyramid didn't take advantage of the pyramid, presumably nearly as much as they could have, given how much you could clearly take advantage of the pyramid.
Yeah, and I want to pick up the American century idea, because you actually wrote a great foreign policy column on just this idea of an anti-American century. And to be precise, you're not saying anti-America in the like I hate America sense. You're saying right. We are entering in the 21st century a world that's the inverse of this 1940s, 1950s.
Right. It is antithesis of yes. American century.
Exactly.
I mean, anti-American is, it's a good headline because it grabs attention, but
it is a good headline.
No, that's why I was clicked.
Like,
it worked.
I was the like, system... Marshall, who are we interviewing? I was like, who is this guy? You know, that's not joking.
Yeah. And so here's the question then. What does it mean for everyone who's listening to this conversation to live within your framework and anti-American century where you cannot go back? So we can't just say, okay, so let's take Groton and Yale and make sure that there's a diverse set of voices and then we'll be good to go, because that clearly isn't going to be what makes the difference there. So what does it mean to live in this society or even this world that we're growing up or just living in?
So just so people, in case they know, the American century was a long article written by Henry Luce in 1941. Henry Luce, who creates Time Magazine and Fortune, who also went to Yale, also was part of these worlds, and was funded by Brown Brothers Harriman with his startup capital, just so we're clear. What I say is the anti-American century is that there were three pillars of the American century that Luce laid out and that this establishment enforced: financial, military, and political. That the dollar and the ability of the United States to create domestic prosperity and export that model to the world to enhance global prosperity would determine an American century. That our political commitment to an open society and democracy would enhance the freedoms of all. And that the military, which Luce doesn't really talk about, but becomes a central part of the American century, really with the Korean War, not before, would be the bulwark against the ultimate threats to that coming from whoever. And all I'm suggesting is that the first 20 years of the 21st century has seen each of those assertions of American preeminence you know, we have the strongest military in the world, but we completely don't know how to utilize it, judging from Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We have an incredibly potent political system, but we have some of the most degraded democratic structures of any democracy in the world, meaning people's own conviction in democracy has been waning. And this was true before Trump. And things like freedom and access are questionable. You know, we don't demand people vote. We make it harder for people. I'm not even getting into the political argument. I'm saying, well, before Trump, we have a democracy that's fraying relative to others. And we went around the world. You know, I managed a fund that invested in Chinese and U.S. companies for about 6 years in the first decade of the 21st century. And every time I went around to talk to people, the question they always asked was, okay, when are Chinese banks going to collapse under the weight of bad loans? And it's only a matter of time, whether it was a hard landing or a soft landing. And I don't know if I want to invest in China because of that. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know the question that everyone should have been asking me is, when were American banks going to collapse under the weight of bad loans? Because they're the ones that collapsed and not the Chinese ones. So I think basically all three pillars of the American century have been severely dinged in a way that I hope leads to a greater level of American humbleness. Another thing about that establishment, you know, in a weird way, as elite as they were, they didn't think that they were like above the human condition. You know, and maybe that was their Presbyterianness, and maybe it was their belief that we're all sinners. I don't know. But they weren't nearly as arrogant as Americans became later in the 20th century about all the things that we were. And I think that is an absolutely important, I think humbleness as a aspect of leadership is a completely undervalued necessity.
Yeah. And there's something I want to understand from that article, because you basically, not to put too many words in your mouth, you basically conclude with the reality that Americans have to accept from this anti-American century is, it's not just the humbleness, but it's the decline in exceptionalism, because these pillars that make us the exception were going away. And I'm wondering, is it not possible that you're overcorrecting a bit, in the sense that, for me, the takeaway is, hey, don't invade Iraq. Hey, actually, we can maintain a forward-facing U.S. military presence in Germany, in Japan. But yeah, we shouldn't start massive land wars or engage in like military forward regime change. What's the balance between us having to accept that the world has just changed and us just behaving in a more mature manner? So a more mature country, a more mature empire wouldn't pull a 2003. And I don't think we're going to pull 2003. I don't think the Biden administration is going to pull Libya. So what's the balancing act there?
So it's funny about American exceptionalism, right? If you look through these particular elites, you know, the kind of the WASP elite, they almost never talk about American exceptionalism. Even Luce, if you read that article, and it's a long article that's gotten reduced to a simple idea, basically says that the American century depends on Americans being economically vibrant. It depends on us working and working mm-hmm. hard. It does not depend on some sort of statement of truth that we are exceptional and therefore will be exceptional and therefore are more exceptional than other humans. There were always elements of that in the 19th century, you know, the self-laudatory backpatting, as there are in every culture. But the degree to which American exceptionalism, starting in the 80s, as kind of a reaction to the 70s and 60s, is also somewhat of a new thing. You know, this constantly touting how wonderful and great you are comparatively, which, I mean, to some degree, that elite would have simply seen as unsavory, right? You know, a gentleman doesn't brag about X, his wallet, his clothes, his status. He may live it, but he wouldn't have bragged about it. But the non-bragging also carried with it a degree of recognition of, you know, you shouldn't constantly be banging the drum about how fantastic you are. So I think there's more than a little bit of an issue in the degree to which American exceptionalism has become a kind of an aspect of a culture war, where, you know, basically both sides are racing for exceptionalism. So remember, the right now is typically going to say we're the freest, greatest, most powerful, wonderful nation in the world. The inverse of exceptionalism on the left is we are the worst, most terrible, most destructive, most, you know, venal country in the world. Like, if we're not the best, we're the worst. That's both a distortion, right? They are both American exceptionalism. the anti-exceptionalism of the left is just as unhumble. You know, it's the arrogance of terribleness.
And that's a really good formulation. Yeah, I haven't heard it put that way, but go ahead if you have more to say.
No, I mean, absolutely, yeah. Borrow it, use it.
You know, I'm stealing it, just so you know. Yeah,
I'd be, no,
I'd be like, you're exceptional in how much you hate your own country relative yeah. to
And I think that there's a lot of, I think we need to look at that more. And again, I think like lessons for the present are, we can argue about whether or not there should be a forward presence for the United States. I think it's less about whether we have, 20,000 troops somewhat keeping the peace somewhere than whether or not we intend to use those troops to enforce the peace somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, the UN has troops around the world. They are sometimes effective buffers. You know, they're not supposed to fight, but they are still sometimes effective buffers. Right. So it's a way of saying, look, it is incumbent on those who have X to give back Y. That should not be a debatable statement. You know, that shouldn't be incendiary. It shouldn't be political. And it should be incumbent on all of us to think about what is in the collective good and not just what's in our own self-interest. And that shouldn't be contradictory to a capitalism that says, I want to, have profit, period.
And so you put this all together, the epitome of the East Coast establishment, the development of these institutions and more. And if there is a single challenge to that idea, I think it is the U.S. relationship with China, something that you ran a company, you wrote a book about it as well. And so that's one of the things I really want to talk about here, which is that let's talk about the U.S. relationship with China in the context of your own career and also in the way that they architected this system, because they very much architected this system and created the conditions for Chinese entrance into the WTO, the idea that increased trade liberalization would lead to societal liberation. I don't think that they could have formulated the Deng Xiaoping model of, we're going to use this capitalist funding in order to bolster the social, Chinese socialism with Chinese characteristics, to bolster a state-funded capitalism, which, taking advantage of American openness, has now become near enough to a peer competitor that the story of the century will be the clash between these two powers. So let's talk about it in terms of Brown Brothers Harriman, and also bring in some of your own work around, I think, talked about. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I probably disagree with both of you about what China represents for the United States now. Mm. The Brown Brothers people who were in government, Robert Lovett in particular, who really was at the center of the security establishment, was, George Marshall's number two at both the Defense Department, but the State Department and then the Defense Department, and then was Secretary of Defense, not just during the Korean War, but during the implementation of something called NSC 68, which was the National Security Council document that really establishes the hard Cold War that we think of. But not just containment, but a unequivocal perception that Soviet communism represented not just an existential threat, but a clear and present danger to the United States, to capitalism, and to the Western world. And that it was incumbent on us to do everything we could to first halt its expansion and potentially roll it back. The debates about whether or not that was the right policy certainly were the crucial debates in the 60s and 70s. They're much less agitated now because it's over. It's an interesting question what this cohort would have done in the face of China. Because largely what they're reacting to in the Soviet Union is not just an antithetical system. Because in the 1930s, Avril Harriman is back and forth, or in the 20s, with Moscow trying to do deals for manganese mines in the Caucasus. Like, clearly, the nature of the Soviet state was not so troubling to an ardent capitalist in the 20s and 30s. The issue is that when the perception of the rhetoric and the actions in Eastern Europe was that Soviets were determined to spread their system everywhere, that it was a universal ideology of global Soviet Marxist-Leninist revolution that really set off the Americans to believe this is not just a weird system the Russians are implementing. It's a weird system that they're trying to implement everywhere. And if we don't stop them, it will imperil our way of life. I see zero evidence of that in anything the Chinese are doing. And we could debate about whether or not they're trying to do it in a bunch of islands relative to the Philippines, or whether Taiwan is a touch point. But that's a different thing of, are they literally trying to create a world of Chinese, Deng Xiaoping, capitalism with authoritarian mm-hmm. governance? because it sure ain't communist. I mean, it's whatever it is. It's capitalist authoritarianism. It's, you know, capitalist oligarchism. There's no word that we really have for what China is. And therefore, I think the obsession with China and what it's doing and the idea that it's a threat to us is massively overblown. And also that the only way to offset it is kind of what Luce was saying in 1940, which is have the strongest, most vibrant domestic economy as possible. And then most of the threat that that represents will go away. You know, they're not building a military to invade us. They're building a cyber capacity to harm us, but that's also because we have a massive cyber capacity to harm them. And were you them, you'd do the same thing. So look, I just don't agree that the focus on China as a threat, competitor, sure, you know, as a spur to don't be complacent, absolutely. As a threat, no.
Yeah, no, that's important actually, because I don't think people should take away from any of my commentary that I do think that it's equivalent to Soviet communism in any way. Like you said, very different in terms of its revolutionary ideology. One Belt, One Road can be seen much more in like an expansionary economic direction around challenging American economic supremacy. And at the heart, you know, Soviet communism was ideologically opposed to the United States, antithetically in a way the Chinese socialism just, or whatever the hell it is, simply is not. And so thinking about it from that perspective, it's very important, like you said, that we don't analogize the same and say, well, we're going to bring back the same situation. Look, if the Chinese want to stay under the CCP, that's fine. That's their business. I think the question is around importing Chinese authoritarianism into our domestic economy, where most Americans have woken up to say, hey, what happened here with the NBA was wrong. Like, we cannot have Daryl Morey not be able to speak his mind as an American citizen. We are not going to have flagship symbols of American culture bow to Xi Jinping. I think that is not, and see, that it's critical. That's not a military threat. It's actually a discrete thing that came about via economic conditions. So just right. If reframing it a little bit that way, what's your perspective?
I think the other thing that Americans are woefully unprepared for simply by lack of past correlates is dealing with China today is so unlike with dealing with the Soviet Union in 1950, because the economic intertwinement is incomparably greater. And the amount of bilateral trade between the United States and the Soviet Union in 1950 could literally have been counted on one hand. You know, it was in the millions of dollars. And even in like purchasing power adjustment, it was in the, you know, $100 million. The United States and China today, even with years of Trump tariffs, intense rhetoric, lots of animosity, is still approaching $1 trillion a year, you know, with a T, and has barely budged downward and actually went up during the pandemic. And, you know, those supply chains took multiples of that trillion to construct. And while slowly, you know, companies are diversifying their supply chain because nobody wants a really vulnerable supply chain, and we learn from the pandemic, like, you don't want all your PPE and different stuff all made in one country. So that's probably a healthy thing. Even so, if you're going to say, we don't want to do all this with China, which is fine, and ignore that interdependence, you're being a fool. And I think it's something that's, no, I'm not saying you are. I'm saying the belief that we can just snap our fingers and go, oh, screw them. You know, they can't tell us what to do. No, they can't and they shouldn't. But the flip side is, it's pretty hard for us to tell them what to do, you know, and we shouldn't think that we can, because we are intertwined. Intertwined doesn't mean they have more power or less. We probably have more power in any metric of power. But we don't have enough more power to either be coercive or walk away. And that's a really tough place. And simply criticizing the fact that we got here doesn't do much, right? You could say, we should never have gotten in bed with the Chinese. We made a terrible mistake letting them into the WTO. Okay, well, we did, and here we are. And saying it was a terrible mistake does nothing, right? What are we supposed to do with the, well, you know, with it, all of, go on.
I just wanted to do a quick addendum. There's two versions of that, right? Because, and you've done some, I really appreciated your early coronavirus piece on globalization. And you're not optimistic, but it's like, this is a phase change. This is going to continue. I think that it matters to say the WTO thing could have been a mistake if it's a pushback against ovary ideological, non-analytical analyses of the world. So like if we're saying China WTO ascension was a mistake, therefore we shouldn't overdo our Tom Friedman references from 2004 about boats being lifted. I think that's, and once again, that usually is missing from that, but I do want to just hit that nuanced point of why I think it personally matters.
That's fair. I mean, to me, it's more if the belief was that China would liberalize, which was certainly part of the belief, not only was that a mistake, but it probably should have been much more circumspect at the time. That doesn't mean China shouldn't have joined the WTO. I mean, even if it was never going to liberalize, the fact that hundreds of millions of people are no longer living in the same level of abject poverty in China is like a good human thing. Even in a crappy system, it's a good human thing. Meaning better to augment your personal security and material well-being than not, full stop. I would say that under almost any set of conditions, you know, you can't eat freedom, right? And you can't like retire on elections. So those are incredibly valuable things, but they're probably less elemental than other things in human existence, which is why it tends to be something you do later and not earlier. Regardless, we are faced with a unique moment for the world and for America of, you know, confronting a competitor or maybe even an adversary that we are also in bed with. I once likened it to a bad marriage that no one can leave. Like you can't afford the divorce, so you're stuck. It's like when somebody moves into the spare couch in the guest room for 2 years because they can't agree on the terms. You know, that's kind of what China and the United States feel like. And they're like, you snipe at each other and you try to get the kids to take one side or the other. Not that the rest of the world are kids, but there's some analogy.
There's something to that.
Yeah.
So, and I, you know, again, I think the Brown Brothers partners, it's hard to know what they would have done in that situation. I am almost certain they would have recognized the structural realities and then, I said at one point when Trump did the tariffs, and I was excoriatingly critical of the tariffs, mostly because I thought they were terrible policy because they simply weren't punitive enough. So that if you wanted to break the relationship, you would have had to make the import of American produced goods from China sufficiently costly that the alternative of constructing new supply chains with more expensive goods would have been attractive at a P&L level and acceptable at a domestic level, which means you would have had to have 100 to 200% tariffs and then several trillion dollars of domestic spending to construct domestic and or, you know, regional supply chains, which weirdly enough would have been the same as China state policy.
Well, you know, as with all things Trump, it half-assed led to the worst.
We wanted to deal with it. This is the key thing. This is the point. Like, the point wasn't actually to...
Yeah, he never wanted the break. He just wanted some deal. Anyway, Marshall, I know you have a
last... Yeah, so let's to take us out of this episode. I actually really appreciate our like disagreements on the broader China things because it's reflecting our idea that these are super complicated things and there obviously isn't going to be a straight party line on basically anything. So... disagreements aside, I think the audience will be split 50-50 between like basically the quote unquote two sides here. What are the debates and choices in front of everyone, regardless of what you say? So once again, like forget the debate about the WTO, sitting in this moment within the context of the anti-American century, within the context of institutional failure, what should we be focusing on and choosing as we knock on wood, slowly emerge from the COVID moment?
So one, you know, first of all, I live in New York City and I feel really strongly that, you know, people who are saying, oh, you know, taxes are going up, government's going left, I'm out of here. You know, if I could agree with the first two, and I'm not actually saying I fully agree with the first two, I am unbelievably, unequivocally critical of the third option. So the I'm out of here because I don't like it is the same thing as the tech elites basically saying, I don't want to deal with people's discomfort about wealth accumulation or data privacy or, you know, how I'm using my internal marketplace. I'll just try to forestall regulation as much as possible and in the meantime, consolidate my position, and then hopefully make sure that the regulations are such that it actually creates an anti-competitive moat to new entrants, which is kind of what, you know, Dodd-Frank did in 2010. You know, it hobbled fintech. It didn't have fintech. That you have a responsibility to engage in shaping the world you want to live in, particularly if you have money and power. And, you know, some money conveys a little bit of power, not nearly as much as people who have money think, but nonetheless. And checking out or, you know, not believing you have any reason to engage in the fray, I think is simply, it's a mercenary form of capitalism that it does not serve the collective, even if you can get away with it. So I think anybody, you know, is it's incumbent to engage these questions and try to shape them. Full stop. And then we can have the disagreements about what it should be. But weirdly enough, once you've committed to engaging in a little more, it gets more interesting. And I think the answers get more dynamic. And there, you know, there are a lot of people who I disagree with still who don't get as much attention, whether it's in Congress or elsewhere, who are trying to grapple with these issues because they feel it's important.
Really well said. Well, Zach, we really appreciate you joining us. It's been a fantastic episode. People can check out the book on our bookshop or on Amazon. Is there anywhere else you want to direct people?
No, I just want people to buy multiple copies for their friends, their family, their bookshelf. You know, people sometimes want, it's a black book. I mean, it's the covers right there. So
yeah,
if your room decor allows for that, several in the room, I think could be...
I think it would look great. It's going to be on my bookshelf. I can guarantee it. So we appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. As per usual, you've asked, how can you help us? You can help us by sharing this show with your friends and family, by rating it, by publicizing it. We really appreciate it. We actually ran into a really nice listener of the show over the weekend, and he said, what's up? So please say what's up, but you could also just share the show. Love it. Appreciate it. And of course, a huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. See you next time.